dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, we played material from the International Inquiry into 9/11, a three-day conference that took place in San Francisco from March 26th through 28th. This week, we'll continue with more of the presentations from the conference. I'm attempting insofar as possible to present the material in chronological order, but it's been necessary to bend that rule a little in order to fit the maximum number of presentations into the time slot for the show. So, here we go.
Our next speaker is going to be Mike Rupert, and he's going to be... Hooray! We got some fans! All right. Mike's topic is going to be what didn't happen on 9/11. Mike, of course, is the former LAPD cop who blew the whistle on CIA drug smuggling into Los Angeles and as a result got forced to resign or got fired, depending on how you look at it, and has been chasing after the truth ever since. He's got a tremendous newsletter called From the Wilderness, and if you want to visit his website, fromthewilderness.com, you can become a subscriber and a supporter of Mike's. I think you'll find him one of the most colorful 911 presenters that we have. And without further ado, please help me welcome Mike Rupert.
Hi, everybody. Are we having fun? And we are going to, we only have, like, I'm going to talk for 30 minutes. And do you realize that in 34 lectures in 8 countries, I have never spoken for 30 minutes? That's good news and the bad news. The good news is that I don't have to talk for 3 hours about what I'm going to talk about tonight. 9/11 is something that is so intense, but it doesn't need to be overcomplicated. And what I'm going to do for you tonight is to make the exact same presentation I would make if I were a detective presenting a case for prosecution on strictly the issue of the FAA and NORAD response on September the 11th. And you know what? What's so beautiful about this is that it doesn't have to be overly complicated. As a matter of fact, it's so simple, it's scary. As a matter of fact, it's so simple, it may help you to understand why the rest of the world doesn't seem to want to get 9/11, or why the rest of the world doesn't want to deal with 9/11, because there was an old commercial that I used to like in the 1970s for Burger King with a young star named Rodney Allen Rippey. And they handed this young, he was like a 4-year-old boy at the time, a big Whopper, and he picked it up and said, "It's too big to eat." And for many people, 9/11 is too big to eat. But to understand the fact, and let me not mince words here, that 9/11 was not only premeditated, was not only, was not only facilitated by the Bush administration. The Bush administration were, in fact, criminal accomplices, equally guilty of murder with anyone else who participated in those attacks. Period. Now, if we can just get the, yeah, we did it. Okay, we're in a slideshow mode. Now, very briefly, just to give you an overview, many people wonder about how such a quote-unquote conspiracy could be carried out. They say, oh, thousands of people would have had to know. The answer is no. How many people in the room have ever participated in a covert operation? One. I have, unwittingly. That's the one that led me to resign from LAPD when I saw that CIA was bringing drugs into the country and I was asked to become a part of it. I have studied a great many covert operations. I have interviewed a great many covert operatives. And the fact is, you don't need a whole lot of people to know. You need key people in key places. For the first reason, there's something called compartmentalization, where you only have a person in one room working on a bolt, a person in another room working on a nut, a person in another room working on a screw, and nobody knows what the finished product looks like. That's metaphors for covert operations. But also, you only need a few people in key places. One of the stories that From the Wilderness has broken and will continue to break, and which will appear in a book which I will have out this year. We're probably going to change the title of the book to match our video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11. But we identified in the FBI a man named David Frasca. Now, somebody lend me this. There, David Frasca. The FBI is a radical fundamentalist unit at FBI headquarters, who single-handedly suppressed five separate investigations, each one of which could have prevented the attacks of 9/11. One of which was the suspension of an investigation into of Osama bin Laden's relatives, Abdullah and Omar. That was the story broken by Greg Palast at BBC. The second was the Chicago agent, Robert Wright, who was he gave a chilling press conference at the National Press Club in tears, where he apologized to the 9/11 families. He had penetrated Al-Qaeda financing. The next was, of course, the Phoenix memo by Special Agent Ken Williams. You might recall when that came out in 2002, which talked about, there's all these Arab fundamentalist guys taking flight training lessons. Don't you think we might want to check other flight schools around the country? And David Frasca's decision was to suppress that request and suspend all investigations, saying they didn't have time, when you can go on the web and get a list of all the flight schools. Of course, there was the Colleen Rowley case, Time Magazine's Woman of the Year, the FBI agent in Minneapolis investigating Zacharias Moussaoui, Frasca's behavior was so brutal it caused her to write an 18-page memorandum, much of which I have quoted in my book, which describes deliberate, willful, malicious actions, not acts of neglect. And then finally, the accidental or intentional destruction of all kinds of carnivore email intercepts out of the Denver office, all of which was ordered by the Radical Fundamentalist Unit headed by Dave Frasca, again, which had those emails been pursued instead of destroyed, could have prevented the attacks at 9/11. What happened to him? He got promoted after 9/11. I owe a great debt, as we go through what we're doing here tonight, to two people, two of my dear friends and very respected colleagues, one of whom I just got to meet tonight for the first time. But Nafiz I have met before. Nafiz Ahmed, author of The War on Freedom, who provided some of this research that I'm about to show you, and the other is Paul Thompson, who has the most incredible timeline. I mean, I started this little timeline called Oh Lucy, which caused a lot of people to attack me right after 9/11, but I started exposing things, and it was very successful. It was taken from Lucy Arnaz. Oh, Lucy, you got a lot of explaining to do. And that's where I got the title for that. Paul Thompson's timeline is the sine qua non of 9/11 research. His website is cooperativeresearch.org, and I thank both of these fine gentlemen for the work that they have done. Yeah, they deserve it. All right, now is Phil Berg here? Yeah, there you are. All right, you're the DA, and I'm the dick, as we call them in police terms, coming in to make a case. Here's the law. Consider that an aircraft, this is from the FAA operations manual, consider that an aircraft emergency exists when there is an unexpected loss of radar contact and radio communications with any aircraft. Elsewhere, the FAA states emergency determinations under a section called emergency determinations. If you are in doubt that a situation constitutes an emergency or potential emergency, handle it as though it were an emergency. No equivocation in language there. Aircraft goes off course. They don't answer the radio. They deviate in any way, shape, or form. If these conditions exist, you can't get a response. If this says clearly, you shall treat it as an emergency. In the next slide, we talk about Payne Stewart. And Payne Stewart, most of you are familiar with. He was leaving Florida, flying a Dallas Learjet. Massive explosive decompression at 35,000 feet. Everybody dies. The reason why that happened, by the way, was because they had a chest with dry ice on board that wasn't supposed to be there, which affected the pressure in the cabin. Air Force fighter jets were scrambled and flying alongside the Payne Stewart plane within minutes. And this is a quote from stories about that, and Nafiz caught it. Pilots are supposed to hit each fix with pinpoint accuracy. If a plane deviates by 15 degrees or 2 miles from that course, the flight controllers will hit the panic button. They'll call the plane saying, American 11, you're deviating from course. It's considered a real emergency, like a police car screeching down a highway at 100 miles an hour. When golfer Payne Stewart's incapacitated Learjet missed a turn at a fix heading north instead of west to Texas, F-16 interceptors were quickly dispatched. Indeed, listen to this.
The U.S. military has their own radar network, NORAD. They are tied to the FAA computer in order to get information on incoming flights. If a target is discovered without a flight plan or information, or in violation of the same, they will call on the shout line to the appropriate ATC, Air Traffic Control Center, for an ID. If the center sector has no data block or other information on it, the military will usually scramble and intercept flight, and they will likely find two F-18s on their tail within 10 or so minutes. Close quote. In the year prior to 9/11, U.S. Air Force and Air National Guard fighter jets were scrambled 67 times on a routine basis under these circumstances and were flying beside the designated target within a matter of minutes, usually less than a half an hour, but the scramble order was issued immediately according to the book. Now, I left some things backstage, and maybe I can ask backstage, there are some papers that I left back there, because I'm going to need to refer to some footnotes. If somebody could grab those maybe and bring them out to me before we get into this. Now, let's look at this thing I call pulling the trigger. This is from a 1998 FAA Executive Order number 760.4J, effective November 3, 1998. It's on the website. That's the website listing. According to FAA regulations, it is the FAA hijack coordinator who issues all requests for the military to provide interceptions and escorts. And no, there's a whole stack of papers back there on the sofa that have footnotes in them I'm going to need. It is the to provide interceptors and escorts, and the hijack coordinator will do so, quote, by direct contact with the National Military Command Center. That's in the Pentagon. Now, there was some misinformation spun after 9/11 because we had planes hijacked out of New York, Boston, and Dulles. That's the ones. Thank you. There was some confusion. But what we see here is that at NORAD headquarters, which are in Colorado, there's only one guy who sits on the trigger, just like we saw with Dave Frasca, for all of the hijacked airliners on 9/11. His instructions are brutally clear. There is no leeway for his choice in the matter as to what his options are when certain conditions exist. And here's another quote that from the Associated Press on August 13th. Fighter jets scrambled 67 times properly in the calendar year prior to 9/11. Now, this is a chart that I will be publishing in my book, and for members of the press only, because I only have 15 copies. I have this chart, which is fully footnoted, and you will see up here on the screen that I have a little footnote beside each one, which gives you the source from where I got the information. And we're going to go through this timeline now, exactly as I would do if I was in court, because it's according to this timeline that I can ask questions of witnesses under direct examination. If this happened at this time, what did you do then? And if you did not follow the procedure, why did you not follow the procedure? It is a cut and dried case of direct examination, or if I were a detective, what I would say to a suspect or possible suspect or person of interest in the case. But we go, and you probably can't see this, so I'm going to have to read them quickly, but we're going to go through this. The morning of September the 11th, 8:13. Last routine contact with Flight 11. Immediately thereafter, the pilot fails to respond to a call to climb to a new altitude. Flight 11 took off at 7:59. Source for that, Boston Globe. 8:13, Flight 11 hijacked. Source for that, item number two. That comes from the Nashua Telegraph. It's also on the NORAD timeline. 8:14, pilot, Flight 11, activates talkback button. Controller can hear conversation in the cockpit. Every commercial airliner has a series of three buttons on the control yoke. I may miss up the frequencies. I think it's 7400, 7500, 7600, which are called the IFF, Identify Friend or Foe buttons. One is in-flight emergency, one is hijack, and there's another one for some other emergency. The hijack button was activated on the control yoke, which allows controllers to hear conversations in the cockpit. That source is from Christian Science Monitor. There's a real fine conspiracy theory paper, September 13, 2003. So we know from these events right now that at this point that at between 8:13 and 8:14 a.m. in the morning, we have confirmation, according to what the FAA would know, that Flight 11 had been hijacked, period. There is no question. At that point, immediately, the scramble order should have been issued. That's the horizontal line that I have on the chart right up here. Now we're going to look at some delays. A20, Flight 11 stops transmitting IFF beacon, confirming that it had been activated. In other words, we now know from another source that if the IFF beacon was turned off, that it must have been turned on. NORAD definitely should have been notified. We have more confirmation. 8:20, Flight 11 veers dramatically off course, AM. FAA absolutely should have been notified. We have now two or more conditions existing. 8:20, Boston Air Traffic Control decides that Flight 11 is a hijack. Official timeline shows other ATCs are not notified for 5 minutes. That didn't happen 67 times in the calendar year prior to 9/11. Why were they not notified? At 8:20, Flight 77 departs Dulles Airport in Virginia. At 8:24, the pilot of Flight 11 activates the talk button. Boston Air Traffic Control overhears hijackers. The transponder has been off now for 10 minutes. 10 minutes since the point in time at which it was mandatory for the scramble order to have been issued. 8:25, Boston Air Traffic Control notifies other ATCs that flight is hijacking. They don't notify NORAD yet for another 13 minutes. Now, if I had the witness on the stand, and I will show you who the witness is before we're done tonight, the question would be, wait a minute, 67 times this happened in the year prior to 9/11. Now, you're telling me on 9/11 you have a confirmed hijacking, the first in recent history, and yet you waited 13 minutes after you knew, but then you already knew back at 8:14 that it was a hijack. Why did you not, for this 11 minutes here, notify anybody that anything was going on? If we come down to 8:28, Boston Air Traffic Control sees Flight 11 make a 100-degree turn to the south. Air traffic controls confirm they never lost sight of Flight 11. They never lost sight of Flight 11. Now, one thing I'll tell you, I don't think I have the slide in here. It is an absolute lie, and I think I may have it later on. The government has said, gee, when we lost the transponder, we couldn't pick them out of all the other airplanes in the sky. That is not true. We have complete conflicting testimony from FAA people and from pilots showing not only does that highlight the aircraft on every screen in every region, but we know that the Department of Defense, the NORAD radar, separate, has a skin paint capability capable of determining altitude. So there, nobody ever lost track of anything at any time on 9/11. Boston ATC sees Flight 11 make a 100-degree turn to the south. ATCs confirm they never lost sight of Flight 11. Press accounts confirm that Flight 11's radar dot has been tagged for easy visibility. That means it was on every screen in the region. Even that the plane was being watched by American Airlines headquarters, believe it or not. These contradict a Washington Post story saying that the Boston authorities had lost contact. It's very important to give you the source for that, so I will go back here and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that's the Washington Post, September the 12th. We come down to 8:30. Now, we know that we have a confirmed hijacking in progress. Flight 11 has been hijacked. It's off course. It's lost control. It's a national emergency. And what is President Bush doing? President Bush's motorcade leaves his Florida hotel for the Emma Booker Elementary School 9 miles away. The journey takes an incredible 25 minutes to go 9 miles. As Bush is leaving, he is asked by a reporter, quote, do you know what's going on in New York? Bush says, he does. Source, 13, maybe good for Bush. ABC News, September 11th, 2001. It's amazing what happens when you get on these things right as they happen. 8:37, sector air traffic control asks pilot of Flight 175 to look for a lost plane. Huh? The plane is not lost. Pilot of 175 says they can see Flight 11 and are told to keep away. 8:40, Boston Air Traffic Control notifies NORAD of Flight 11 hijacking. Wait a minute, it's been 26 minutes now. We're talking about this line right here, 26 minutes. Since we knew that it was a hijacking, since NORAD, according to their own procedural manual, would have known it was a hijacking, and yet we have a 26-minute delay before the air traffic control notifies NORAD, which is where the one guy who pulls the trigger for scramble is sitting. Why did that happen? Good question. Somebody needs to ask it. We come right down to 8:40. Two pilots at Otis Air Force Base at Cape Cod are told of the hijack, yet no scramble order is given. What? It happened 67 times in the year prior. Source for that, number 16. is the Cape Cod Times, August 21st. They went right out to the airbase. 8:42, Flight 93 takes off from Newark after a 40-minute delay. That's kind of interesting. That's right here. 8:42, Flight 175 veers off course. According to the FAA manual, if you have any doubt, you shall assume and proceed as if it was an emergency. 8:42, an air traffic control says, looks like he's heading southbound, but there's no transponder, no nothing. Now from another press report, which is from the New York Times on October 16th, we have a plane off course and no transponder. Now, under FAA rules and procedures, it is axiomatically an emergency and a hijacking. A second set of scramble orders should be given, so we know that the Flight 175 hijacking is confirmed at 8:42. At 8:43, NORAD is notified of the 175 hijack. 8:43, gee, that's just like a minute later. Now, why did they wait so long for one, do the second one immediately? But listen to this. Over here on the right, it says, at 8:46, scramble orders are issued at Otis Air Force Base to go after Flight 11, 190 miles away. Fighters from closer bases like Atlantic City are not scrambled. 8:46 a.m., Flight 11 impacts World Trade Center. 8:46, acting chief of the typo in here. Acting Joint Chiefs Chairman Richard Myers claims that he sees a TV report about the plane hitting. Now, didn't we just hear in the FAA procedural manual that the FAA hijack coordinator, now we have seen a scramble order issued very late, is to do this with the National Military Command Center, which is in the Pentagon, which reports directly to the Joint Chiefs. And General Richard Myers claims he did not know the two airplanes had been hijacked at 8:46 in the morning. The procedural manual says he certainly knew. 8:46, Flight 175 stops emitting a transponder signal 50 miles north of New York City. Other reports state that 175 had turned off its transponder, then back on again and on an unassigned frequency. There is no doubt now that we have an emergency under any circumstances. Over here at 8:46, three F-16s assigned to Andrew Air Force Base are flying air-to-ground strike training mission 200 miles from Washington. Instead of being ordered to D.C. at supersonic speeds, they return to base, slowly landing only after Flight 77 hits the Pentagon. They could have been in D.C. airspace within 10 minutes. 8:46, Flight 77 is reported by ATCs to be severely off course. Three scrambles. After 8:46, National Military Command Center's officials in the eastern part of the Pentagon are talking to law enforcement officials about possible responses. What? The responses are already dictated for them in their manuals. You shall scramble fighters immediately. Now we have a report saying they were debating whether to, there was no leeway. They're debating when it's before them in black and white what it was they were supposed to do. That is, at best, civilly. A civil negligence suit of the utmost extreme. Of course, we believe it's criminal, and I agree that the RICO suit should put all those people in jail once we find out who they are, and we'll get there. All right. I could have said something not quite as nice as putting them in jail, but that's all right. Flight 77 is reported off course. We come to 8:46. Okay, so they're talking about what to do next at 8:46. After 8:46, the FAA has an open line to the Secret Service. They can't manage to follow their own procedures, but they're talking directly to the Secret Service in the White House. It's confirmed by Vice President Cheney. I'll just tell you the source on that real quick, because already I see I'm running out of time. That was NBC News, right after the attacks. After 8:46, the NORAD and National Military Command Center have open phone lines. 8:46 to 9. Navy Captain Deborah Lauer in the Bush motorcade receives a message from the White House Situation Room about the first impact. This is before Bush even walks into. But notice that we already have three confirmed hijackings. Yet he decided to go into the room to read to the kids. Why? Probably so he could give a plausibly acceptable denial as to why he couldn't issue the order to shoot the planes down. because he knew that they had to have the attacks. Bush later stated, that, of course, that he saw the video of the attacks and said, oh, boy, that's a terrible pilot. Well, of course, the video wasn't played for hours of the first crash. 8:46, Barbara Olson, wife of U.S. Solicitor General, calls her husband at Justice Department. He calls the Justice Department Command Center and advises of a hijacking. Now, wait a minute. We got the Solicitor General getting a cell phone call, calling the Justice Department, saying there's a hijacking, and yet FAA has not issued scramble orders for all three flights. Somebody needs to go to jail. 8:46. First TV and news reports of the plane crashing into the World Trade Center. This is the latest time that Bush over here could have known, been asked by events by a reporter at his hotel when he indicated that he already knew. 8:50, last radio contact with Flight 77. Pilot asks for clearance to a higher altitude, then does not respond to a routine instruction. Otis Air National Guard orders pilots take off 12 minutes after receiving notification. That's nonsense. Flying their F-15s at top speed, 1,875 miles an hour, with a supersonic cruise speed of 1,600 miles an hour. If you do the math on the ones that went to the Pentagon, they had to have been flying at 300 miles an hour on this rush national emergency. 8:55, Flight 77 turns around. More confirmation. I mean, there's no doubt what's going on, but watch these delays that come down here when NORAD and the FAA did not do what it was they were supposed to do. I go through a lot of stuff, which we apparently will not have time to do tonight. I'm sorry. A news photographer traveling with Bush entourage overhears a radio transmission that Press Secretary Ari Fleischer would be needed on arrival to discuss reports of the crash. That's before 8:58. Latest confirmed arrival of Bush at the Booker Elementary School, 41. We got three confirmed hijackings in place, and he knows about it. And he has not lifted a finger to get anything up in the air. He has not mobilized the military. No executive orders have been issued from the White House, not from Dick Cheney, not from the National Command Authority. Bush is taken to a holding room and briefed by Condi Rice. Boy, there's a woman we can really distrust. Taken to a holding room and briefed, yet he decided to go ahead and read. 9:01, the pilots of Flight 93 acknowledge a general FAA warning. Now the FAA is issuing warnings about cockpit intrusion. Duh. Request to barricade doors. Pilots are not told of the WTC crash. Now I'm using a lot of stuff from the NORAD and FAA timelines, actually. At this time, Bush cannot be approached because he's in the discussions. Flight 17 hits Tower 2 of World Trade Center. This has all happened before the second plane hits the World Trade Center. Now I'm using the government records, ABC News, mainstream news, NORAD, FAA timelines. All you got to do is lay this out and look at it. By 9:05, West Virginia ATC's notice an eastbound plane with no transponder entering their airspace. It's Flight 77, right there. All ATC facilities nationwide are notified that the Flight 11 crash was probably a hijacking. Yet the West Virginia ATCs do not notify NORAD that Flight 77 is off course for 18 minutes. Why not? FAA informs NORAD at 9:16 that Flight 93 may have been hijacked. Duh. Look at this. By the book, all fighter aircraft should have been scrambled by this time, and we still have delay after delay after delay. One Air Force pilot at 9:24, codenamed Honey, who piloted an F-16 from Langley, disputes the official version. He says that the call to battle stations was not sounded until 9:24. In other words, even some of the pilots were disagreeing because they can't keep their cover up straight. From 9:27 through 9:30, I got 2 minutes left, boys. Bush talks to Cheney at the White House, but there is no discussion of shooting down Flight 77 or Flight 93. Why? Bush finally leaves Booker at 9:29, and at 9:30, transponder contact on Flight 93 is lost. We come to the next page, 9:32, Flight 77 does that wonderful, what Kristen Breitweiser said, the loop-de-loop over the Pentagon. I love that terminology when she testified, God bless her. And amazing how you learn how to do that with four or five flight lessons. Dives into the side of the Pentagon, which is under construction. At the same time, the Flight 93 hijacking is confirmed. Now, I won't have time to go through all of this, but I will tell you, and I spoke to Phil Berg today, and he and I are both in complete agreement that Flight 93 was shot down.
You cannot have a 5 mile or 4 or 5 mile debris trail. I think the port engine was something like 2.5 miles from the impact site. These multi-ton engines don't bounce 2.5 miles. Multiple witnesses confirm a missile strike on the aircraft, and there were some very strange military planes around that. So when you get to the bottom of all this, nobody did what they were supposed to be doing, and it shows very clear criminally negligent, at best, behavior. I think you have a clear case for conspiracy here. Now, one thing that's very important, and I'll try to speak like the Federal Express guy here, because I just don't know how to do this in 25 minutes. There was, on September 11th, an operation called Vigilant Guardian underway. And this is a story which was pulled from LexisNexis, and I give credit to Barbara Honegger. I don't think that she has been here. Where are you? Well, stand up. There you are. Barb broke this story, which is indeed perhaps perfect camouflage in a way to discredit, or excuse me, to distract air operations commands and behavior, some cases by inserting false blips on radar screen, by saying we're going to have some planned hijackings, and isn't it convenient that this was scheduled to happen on 9/11? It's one way to have confused the air response system so that people would have behaved in a way just to give enough time. But the air traffic controllers have no excuse for not responding according to textbook procedures on September 11th with all of the maneuvers of the aircraft which I identified. They were not part of the exercise. If they don't respond, you still have commercial air traffic out there. Now, as I look through this, the key point that Nafiz brought up was that there was one guy who pulls the trigger for fighter scrambles. That's him, Ben Sliney, or Slinney. His first day on the job, September 11th. He has never testified in public anywhere. He did testify in a closed session in Congress. USA Today has a wonderful little clip of him on their website. You can't find it unless you found it. I found it. I've saved it on PDF, but I couldn't save it to an image. I was going to show it and play it, where he talks about clearing the air traffic all around these hijacked flights and opening the doors, and it was called To and Through, and I'll send the link to the right people at the time. But, you know, if I was a detective, and even though my nickname when I was with LAPD was Inspector Clouseau, even I would have been smart enough to know that Ben Slenny is the first guy you got to talk to about what happened with the fighters. Have we heard a word from Ben Slenny anywhere? Has he been called to testify before the Independent 9/11 Commission? No, he has testified before a closed hearing, a session of the Joint House-Senate Intelligence Committee. The families, God bless them, of the 9/11 Steering Committee have asked a whole list of questions. But it doesn't have to be much more complicated than that as we proceed from here, because we are all nearing a very close window of opportunity to either make 9/11 into an issue that breaks the whole world situation open, or seeing it pass into the dusty archives of history to be discussed like the events of November 22nd, 1963. Our window, one second, I'll come back to you. Our window is now in the course of the hearings. Our window is, and I will talk about this in more detail tomorrow night, the Supreme Court decision pending upon the secret records of the National Energy Policy Development Group, which is where the motive for 9/11 lies. The deepest secrets of 9/11 lie in that task force. It lies when the Commission's final report is released sometime, I believe it's in late July or August, and certainly it will close forever by the presidential election of this November. My plea to all 9/11 activists is that we have to find the sheet music so that we can all sing the same notes. I would submit to you that if I could make this case to you in 20 minutes, we can make the same case to the American people in 20 minutes, and if we keep it simple, we might be able to crack the nut that we need to crack, that we must crack, to save our country, to save our planet, and our civilization. Thank you very much.
That was Michael Rupert, independent investigator and publisher of the From the Wilderness newsletter. For more info on Mike Rupert's work, visit on the web copvcia.com. That's copvcia.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're listening to a presentation from the International Inquiry into 9/11. That took place late last March in San Francisco. The next speaker is Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space.
Good evening. It's nice to be here with you all. There's nothing like personal experiments to inform a person and change their life. During my time in the Air Force during the Vietnam War, I was stationed at Travis Air Force Base here in Northern California, where I was exposed to the peace movement for the first time. I had come from a career military family and had been the vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club at the age of 16 while working on the Nixon campaign. My first roommate at Travis Air Force Base turned out to be a leading GI resistance movement organizer in the barracks. And at night there were meetings of anti-war GIs, or on another night, Black Panthers from the cities talking about racism. I was to get the education of my life. When the Pentagon Papers came out, thanks to the courage of Daniel Ellsberg, all my patriotic illusions, all of my patriotic illusions were shattered. Here was the government's own account of how it had fabricated the pretext to drag our nation into the Vietnam War, and how it was literally sold to the American people by manipulating the media and the Congress. In fact, one very important story within that Pentagon Papers talked about how Ho Chi Minh was going to win the UN-sponsored election. And the CIA was sent in, and they fabricated a letter on Ho Chi Minh's stationery, knowing that the Catholics were a minority in the northern part of Vietnam. The CIA wrote with Ho Chi Minh's signature that if elected, he would round up and kill the Catholics in the north. The CIA then brought in the American media as they began distributing the letter throughout the Catholic community. And a CIA organized mass exodus of Catholics from the north to the south was then filmed. And the film was brought home to the United States and shown to the American people on the national news the next day. The day following, the Congress of the United States made the first emergency appropriation for U.S. military advisors in Vietnam, and that is how the war began. My life was never the same after reading that, and I've been a professional organizer since 1978, first trained by the United Farm Workers Union, and then leading peace and justice organizations since. In 1992, I and a couple of others created the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space in order to try to prevent the next round of the arms race from moving into the heavens. Today I live in Maine and travel around the world talking about space technology and how it now allows the United States to militarily control the entire planet. With space satellites now in place, the United States can see everything on the Earth, hear everything on the Earth, and ultimately target everything and every place on the Earth. The day after 9/11, I went to my world atlas to look up the Central Asian countries that I admittedly knew very little about. What I found is common knowledge these days. They have some of the largest deposits of oil and natural gas in the entire world. Uzbekistan has the world's largest gold mine. My Pentagon Papers experience taught me to always ask the next question: who, what, why, when, and how. For me, 9/11 unleashed a slew of new questions about U.S. foreign and military policy. 5 days after 9/11, I boarded a very empty airplane in Gainesville, Florida, to fly to Cleveland in order to speak about space to a Rotary Club in a Republican neighborhood. While reading the Gainesville Sun newspaper on the plane, an AP story jumped out at me. The piece quoted an unidentified Pentagon spokesman who said, quote, "We've been planning this war for the last 3 years." Of course, the Pentagon spokesman was referring to the almost immediate discussion that the United States had to respond to 9/11 by bombing and invading Afghanistan. Memories of reading the Pentagon Papers again flashed through my mind. We know that the chairman of the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, was meeting with then-Senator Max Cleland on Capitol Hill the morning of 9/11. Planes were crashing into the World Trade Center towers in the Pentagon, and they went right on with their meeting. It was not until after the tragic episodes had occurred that General Myers and NORAD Commander General Ralph Eberhardt made the decision to scramble jets. But by then, it was essentially over. This clearly suggests that the generals knowingly violated mandatory procedures well expressed by the last speaker. But who told them to stand down? Just days ago, on March 23rd, I was listening to NPR coverage of the 9/11 commission hearings in Washington, and Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld was being questioned. The only woman on the panel, a Democrat, asked Rumsfeld why the Pentagon jets were not scrambled to intercept the hijacked planes. He did not answer the question. He droned on about some other nonsense, and no attempt of follow-up was made. And I was not totally surprised. In 2000, a report was written by the now well-known right-wing think tank called A Project for a New American Century. This is an organization which Cheney, Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush, Wolfowitz, Armitage, Bolton, Abrams, Woolsey, Libby, and William Kristol, among others, belong to. The report was called Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. And it asked this question, quote, does the United States have the resolve to shape a new century favorable to American principles and interests? Now, what are the principles and interests that PNAC refers to? Could they be talking about control, corporate control and domination of the world? Could they be talking about the advancement of conditions that creates more of a market for the number one industrial export in America today, weapons? And could it be that control of the oil and natural gas fields, not only in the Middle East, but also throughout Central Asia, Africa, and Latin America, was on their mind? PNAC answers these questions in the report by saying this, the United States is the world's only superpower, combining preeminent military power, global technological leadership, and the world's largest economy. America's grand strategy should aim to preserve and extend this advantageous position as far into the future as possible. But to undertake such a grand strategy and sweeping strategy would be enormously expensive and highly controversial undertaking, not only here at home, but all over the world. And PNAC knows that. So they threw in this bit into the report, saying that to accomplish this transformation, the world was, quote, it would likely be a long one, a long transformation, absent, they say, of some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like, they say, a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. We now hear from the Bush administration insiders, like former Treasury Secretary O'Neill, and more recently Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief under Clinton and Bush, that the Bush team was preparing for war with Iraq from their first days in office. Once selected, George W. Bush began to implement the PNAC strategy, withdrawing from the 1972 ABM treaty that outlawed testing and deployment of so-called missile defense, dramatically increasing military spending, and then establishing plans for military transformation. In fact, the first trip that Donald Rumsfeld took in his new job as Secretary of War was to go to Berlin for a NATO defense ministers meeting. Along with him, he took Henry Kissinger, Senator John McCain, and Senator Joseph Lieberman. Lieberman stood beside Rumsfeld and told the NATO military leaders that, quote, we have bipartisan support for missile defense in the United States, so your countries had better get on board or get left behind. And then came 9/11, and the gloves came off. In his State of the Union speech in 2002, Bush declared that, quote, our war on terror is well begun, but it is only begun, unquote. By June of that same year, he signaled his support for preemptive war, saying that the United States was, quote, ready for preemptive action when necessary to defend our liberty and to defend our lives. Everything, thanks to 9/11, was now in place. Who could have imagined that using conventional democratic means, such as holding national debates that involve the taxpayers and congressional hearings and even votes, that an administration could have successfully committed so much money and so many lives to such a radical new foreign and military policy? But the debate was never heard. It was all done ipso facto by claiming to be a response to 9/11. I'm reminded of another Bush administration and yet another invasion. Following the demise of the former Soviet Union, there was much debate in the United States about the peace dividend. People were saying that we would not be able to, that we would not have to keep these incredible high levels of military spending going any longer, that we could stop spending billions and billions on NATO in Europe, and that we could actually take care of things here at home. But all that was lost in a minute as George Bush I terrorized Panama, killing several thousand innocent civilians in the El Chorrillo neighborhood as U.S. troops burned it to the ground. Manuel Noriega was apprehended in Operation Just Cause, and the talk of a peace dividend was put to rest forever. And now there's much more to come. Because of computerization, mechanization, and robotics, we now have superfluous populations around the world. Rather than share the great wealth of this planet and the diminishing resources like oil and water, the corporate power structure intends to impose a new 21st century form of feudalism that will ensure maximum corporate profits and minimum social progress for all the people of the planet. In order to control and dominate the growing legions of have-nots predicted by the Pentagon in the Space Command document Vision for 2020. A new high-tech space technologies, many new high-tech space technologies will be utilized, and a fast-moving military will be forward deployed to new smaller lily pad bases in global hotspots. The United States now rents or owns more than 700 bases in over 130 countries, in addition to the hundreds of bases in North America. Key regions like Africa, Central Asia, South America, and the Middle East that have scarce natural resources, though not yet under corporate control, will see a string of new bases established, all presumably to fight the war on terrorism. Deputy Secretary of War and PNAC member Paul Wolfowitz told the New York Times in 2002 that the function of these new outposts may be more political than actually military. The new bases, he insisted, would, quote, send a message to everybody, including strategically important countries like Uzbekistan, that we have the capacity to come back in, and we will come back in, he said. China and Russia will be militarily surrounded and contained. In order to pay for this perpetual war, cutbacks in human needs spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, environmental cleanup, on and on and on, will be cut. And we will see this done in all of the industrial and first world societies, as our allies will be brought in at some level or the other to help pay for and implement this new global vision. The Democrats argue around the edges of the policy, but essentially agree with the U.S. corporate empire, the new Rome. They only disagree on the way the policy is implemented. They'd rather see a friendly sheriff rather than a macho tin horn cowboy style presented by Bush and his posse. But the good cop, bad cop debate that goes on at the 9/11 Commission is red meat for the corporate-dominated media and good entertainment for the masses who struggle to understand what happened and why on 9/11. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars will be spent on Star Wars research and development. The Pentagon says it will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. Orbiting battle stations, space-based lasers, what the Pentagon has nicknamed the Death Star, powered with nuclear reactors, are envisioned in the years to come and are under research and development today. Bush will say, let's deploy right now. And the Democrats will say, let's test a little bit longer before we deploy. But both are hostage to the weapons corporations who generously donate to the political campaigns of the compliant politicians. General Richard Myers, the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was previously the commander of the U.S. Space Command, which has been put in charge of giving the United States what we now call full spectrum dominance of the Earth and the space battlefield. His promotion to head the Joint Chiefs shows the ascendancy of Star Wars within the military hierarchy. Permanent bases, 14 of them, are now being established in Iraq, where U.S. troops will be deployed for years to come, remembering George W.'s words that, quote, the American people had better be patient. It's going to be a long, long war. We live in a violent society that is addicted to war and military spending. And like any addict, we must have our regular fix to keep us going. We must always have an enemy, and if necessary, they can be created. And most importantly, we must remain in denial about our addiction. We cannot look at ourselves in the mirror for fear of what we might find standing there. But there are people who are clamoring for treatment. They want to acknowledge the reality of our disease. And your voices will not go away. I can assure you that for the last few years since 9/11, every place I go, where I speak, someone in the audience always asks the question, what happened on 9/11? The entire story of 9/11 might not ever be fully known, but people are thinking about it and have begun to develop their own thoughts on what happened and why. Legions of people in this country are highly suspicious of official explanations, and the demand for the truth will only grow. The 9/11 families are the leaders in the citizens' movement that seeks real answers to serious questions. And events like this international inquiry are the real democracy in this country today. People often ask me what we can do about the corporate-controlled media today. And I tell them we have to become the media. And when we have a corporate-controlled Congress and a corporate-controlled 9/11 Commission who is replaying the Warren Commission theme, we the people have to become the body that explores the issue and asks the tough questions. Could it be that one of the most important purposes of the Notorious Patriot Act is to help create the climate of fear and intimidation in this country that will make the public reluctant to become involved in events like that we see here happening tonight? Is the message to the public, stay away, don't get involved, keep your nose to the grindstone? My congratulations to the organizers of this historic event, and my regards to all of you, citizen activists, who have come in search of the truth. Don't let anyone say that you're joining the conspiracy theorists. The only conspiracy today is the one of deception and silence. The only conspiracy is the one that creates the lack of courage to participate in real democracy. Thank you all very much.
That was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. For more information on the Global Network, visit on the web www.spaceforpeace.org. That's space, the number four, peace.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville.
Nafiz Mozadek Ahmed is our next speaker. He's come all the way from England, where he's executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development, an independent interdisciplinary nonprofit think tank based in Brighton, England. This institute conducts research and analysis of local and global society for the promotion of human rights, justice, and peace. Nafiz Ahmed is the author of The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked, September 11, 2001. And his latest book is Behind the War on Terror, Western Secret Strategy and the Struggle for Iraq. So I want to welcome Nafees to San Francisco and to this inquiry. Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed.
Good morning, everybody. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here, and it's wonderful to see so many people here today. I'm going to talk in a very concise way about the continuity of the war on terror and how the war on terror has really continued a process that was begun many, many, many centuries ago. So I'm going to have to go back in history, and then we'll discuss the dynamics of US foreign policy, British foreign policy, and Western foreign policy, and how those have manifested in different stages in the post-Second World War period up to the post-9/11 period. So we'll begin with what happened after the Second World War. At that time, US national security strategy was inseparable from a particular idea of the functioning of the capitalist world economy. And US national security strategy was specifically designed and drawn up in order to meet the requirements of this economy. Towards the end of the Second World War, there was a strategy known as the Grand Area Strategy, which was drawn up by US State Department planners. They were operating in working groups with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. And there is a wonderful book on this subject, which is unfortunately out of print, but if you can get hold of it, it's worth doing so. It's by Professors Lawrence Shoup and William Minter. It's called The Imperial Brain Trust. And in that book, they basically analyzed this archive of documents that came out of this period when the Council on Foreign Relations with the State Department were working on how to reconstruct world order in the post-Second World War period. And what these planners identified was a minimum world area comprising the entire Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire and the Far East, economic control over which they believed to be, and I quote, essential for the security and economic prosperity of the United States and the Western Hemisphere. Now, this control was premised on being able to secure, and I quote, the limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by foreign nations that constitutes a threat to this world area, which to be effective required an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy for the United States. On this basis, the planners argued that the concept of US security interests had to be extended to include the domination of areas, quote, strategically necessary for world control. In other words, national security discourse was used as a cover, as a way of legitimizing imperial consolidation as part of this grand area strategy. State Department planners, for example, recognized that the British Empire as it existed in the past would never reappear, but that the consequence of this planning was that the United States, and I quote, may have to take its place. So grand area planning was concerned with fulfilling, quote, the requirements of the United States in a world in which it proposes to hold unquestioned power. So top government planners were using the War and Peace Studies project of the CFR to lay plans for what Shoup and Minter describe as a new global order for the post-war world, an order in which the United States would be the dominant power, an imperialistic conception of the national interest and war aims of the United States. It was a conscious attempt to organize and control a global empire. And it is in this context that we have to understand what happened during the Cold War. The main feature of the containment doctrine, the idea that US national security has to contain the threat from Soviet expansionism, which is, you know, threatening to invade us and so on and so forth, and invade our allies, was not actually the fundamental motivating factor behind what happened in the Cold War. This is clear from one of there's a document called NSC 68, which you've probably heard of. And this document is the main one which goes through the whole kind of bipolar system and explains why the United States needs to fight the evil empire of international communism. But if you go through it, it's very, very propagandistic, but there's one very, very revealing statement in there, which many people overlook, and this is what it says. It says, our overall policy at the present time may be described as one designed to foster a world environment in which the American system can survive and flourish. This broad intention embraces two subsidiary positions.